Valerie Tiberius, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
The topic we're going to talk about today is well-being. Can we have a pithy definition of what well-being is?
Well, on my view, the pithy definition would be that well-being is achieving values, a system of values over time in your life. Basically just doing the kinds of things that you care about and continue to care about.
One might think that one definition of well-being was that it was about happiness, that I achieved my well-being when I was as happy as I could possibly be. But you mean it in a much wider sense than that.
I do. I think among psychologists right now that thinking about well-being as a sort of psychological state of felt happiness, you know, that sort of yellow smiley face notion of happiness, it's quite popular. If you read articles in the newspaper, like I just saw one the other day that said New Yorkers are unhappy, that's the sense of happiness that they're talking about, that kind of psychological felt state.
And what's wrong with that as a definition of well-being? Why does that fall short of how we should regard a proper conception of well-being?
Well, for some purposes, it might be an okay thing to think about and to think about trying to promote, because I think, you know, most people value happiness. It's something that most people care about, that nice, happy, good feeling. But if what we're asking is the old philosophical question about the final end of human life, the grand goal of human life, then I think we need something that is more clearly connected to what we almost necessarily see as good. Now, the problem, I think, with these psychological notions is that sometimes they don't actually seem that good when you look at cases of them. For instance, my friend Dan Habron, his favorite case to talk about here is of a prisoner, a convicted criminal on death row who, you know, has turned his life around and found meaning in life on death row, and he feels quite satisfied with his life. But I think from the point of view of what a best human life is and what kind of life we want to promote for humankind, what kind of life we want to help our children to lead, his life has a lot of problems. He would be much better off if he weren't on death row.
I guess he'd be even worse off if he wasn't happy. So does that mean happiness is a necessary component of a sensible conception of well-being?
You're absolutely right. He would be worse off if he were also miserable in addition to his other problems. I don't want to say that happiness is necessary in a really strong sense, but I do think, in fact, it's a component of happiness for every normal person. And for me, that's because people value happiness. Happiness is something people care about, and that's what puts it on the list of things that make someone's life go well.
But basically, your conception is much broader and includes other components of well-being. What might they be?
I think one of the most important ones to my mind is friendship. Friendship does make us happy. Most friendships are pleasant, but there's more to friendship than the happiness that you get out of it. There's also the importance of being a good friend to another person, being someone who can be counted on, being sympathetic and kind and generous. So I think the value of friendship is an important component of well-being and something that most people value, but it doesn't reduce entirely to that kind of psychological happiness.
So one can imagine coming up with a list of what counts as a good life. So is this the way to conceive of well-being, in which happiness is a part, but there are all these other things as well, and there's just a list that one can tick off, as it were?
Right. It sounds like what you're talking about is what philosophers call objective list theories, where well-being consists in possessing these objective goods. And the list of objective goods usually includes happiness, friendship, knowledge. Often it includes moral virtue. Now, I think that kind of theory has something going for it that the psychological, very subjective theories don't have, but I'm still not a fan of the objective list theories because I think they have the wrong explanation for why those good things are good for people. I don't think the goodness comes first so that, you know, you have these good things that are good entirely independently of the humans who pursue them or care about them. Rather, I think that the goodness of the things that are good for us comes from our commitments to them. It comes from the fact that we care about them in a certain way.
So can you give an example there? There has to be a connection between what we value and what is valuable.
Right. This gets us pretty deep into metaethics, actually. This will be oversimplified, but the basic thought is that it's our attitudes that make it the case that there are things of value in the world. If we were not here to care about things, there would be nothing of value. That's my ultimate starting point. It's the starting point that comes from David Hume, that it's our sentiments, our feelings, our emotions and passions that make it the case that there are values in the world. But it's not very plausible to say that whatever a person happens to care about in the moment, that's what's good and valuable. So to my mind, when we have a stable pattern of attitudes towards something such as friendship or health or happiness, that's when we can claim that that thing has real value. We have to care about the thing, but our caring has to be relatively stable over time. And it also has to be the kind of caring attitude that isn't going to be shaken by thinking about it too much. So if you were to ponder how much you are committed to the value of friendship, how much you care about friendship, you could think of some counterarguments or think of some facts about what friendship is like, and I would say that your valuing of friendship wouldn't falter. So it's the valuing that you have of it is stable on reflection, is the way I would put it.
So I could assess the value of friendship and decide that friendship was important, but if I valued something like, I don't know, counting blades of grass, which I'd done for many years, and I looked at myself and thought, that's a pretty odd hobby, that would be the sort of interest that would be unstable and therefore would be jettisoned, or how does it work?
Yes, exactly. Two things, really. I think for most normal people, the value of counting blades of grass is not going to be stable on reflection over time. And partly that's because most normal people will start to find it boring. That said, there could be a very strange person for whom that is the thing. Because I don't accept one of these objective list theories, I do think such a person, they can achieve well-being. Their well-being will just look significantly different from most of us normal folk.
That's very interesting. So it can be a subjective relationship with anything. It doesn't have to be on this list of approved objective values.
That's right. I happen to agree with the objective list people that for most human beings, the kinds of things that will be on that list are happiness, friendship, health, knowledge. What I disagree with them about is the explanation. So I think the reason those things will be on the list for most people is not that those things have some human transcendent objective value. It's that those are things that most normal human beings care about and care about for good reason.
It's a very compelling theory at an abstract level. Does it have any practical significance for how, I don't know, we might approach a friendship or advise a friend?
I think it does. The first thing I want to say about helping people is that sometimes it's very obvious what you need to do to help somebody, and it doesn't matter what your theory is. If your friend is homeless or hungry, you don't need theoretical help to see how to help that person. And I think that's true for a large number of people in the world who have very serious impediments to their well-being, and there are things that we could do for those people that don't require a lot of theoretical sophistication. But as far as cases where it's not as simple to see how to help a person, the value fulfillment theory that I propose does point us in a helpful direction. So first, it directs you to think about what your friend cares about. And second, I think the most important thing is it directs you to think about how your friend is capable of changing. What step could that friend take towards a life in which she has a better, more achievable set of values that she can pursue over time and continue to care about and continue to succeed in those terms. So it really does direct a helping friend to think about that issue of how can the person I want to help get from point A to point B.
So give me a concrete example. Suppose my friend has always wanted to write a novel and is a very bad writer. What should my advice be to that person?
It's very hard to say anything in the abstract, but I think what you would want to think about partly, you know, people will say things like, well, she can't hear that right now, that sometimes people are not ready to hear that their dream is not going to succeed. So you might instead think about ways of suggesting alternatives for creative outlets that don't directly challenge the person's beliefs about their talents. So I'm not going to come at her with the full brunt of the truth. Instead, I'll try to do something kind of sideways to get her to consider possibilities for change that don't really directly challenge some of the beliefs. But you might have a different kind of friend who is at the point where they're sort of on the fence anyway about the writing gig, and they're kind of thinking maybe it's time to call it quits. And at that point, if you are a good enough friend, your input that says, you know what, not everyone can make it as a writer, and maybe you're right, maybe it's not time. That kind of advice could be very well placed for a friend who's ready to hear it.
Final question. Have you actually altered your approach to friends and other acquaintances as a result of thinking about these kinds of matters?
You know, I actually have. I think that the main thing I've taken from my own research is a kind of imperative to be more humble. It seems to me a lot of people who want to be helpful blunder into other people's lives and think they know best. And they think they know best partly because they see a different future for the person that really is better. But the question is whether the person can get to that future from where they are. So I think the one thing that I have changed is that I bite my tongue more. When I think, if only this person would listen to me, their life would be so much better. When I hear that thought in my head, I've taken to think, you know, maybe I should try a little harder to see things from that person's point of view.
That was fascinating. Valerie Tiberius, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.